Welcome back. Tonight we bring to a conclusion our reading of chapter 25, the triple transformation. So, breaking through the crust of the exterior nature to gain access to the interior regions within us, to be able to live from the soul in concert with the deeper powers of our nature, the subliminal mind, the subliminal life parts, the subtle physical, and to range our awareness upwards beyond these instrumentalities into a direct awareness of the self, the universal real being, who in time and out of time is the same reality that we seek. We find it above, surely, transcendent, but we find that it also has cosmic dimension. It empowers itself on all the forms of the universe. And so our spiritual growth, our evolution, must aim at not simply finding the soul and being content in its realization, or even suffusing some of its energies outward to felicitate mind, life, and body. But we have to grow enormously into oneness with the universe and with that which gives the universe its substance. We must become one with the divine reality. We must become aware of it. But being aware of it isn't insufficient. Just as we have to export the powers of the soul into the outer nature, we must bring the higher powers of a greater consciousness down into us here. We must ascend in consciousness, we must rise to the heights of the spirit, but we must bring back those riches, those argosies of light, as Sri Aurobindo calls them, back here to our material frame. And so the first movement is to find the soul. That's the psychic transformation. And the second is to widen our awareness and to heighten our awareness, and that's the spiritual. Transformation means not simply change. We can restructure our nature as we have it, our mental being, our vital being, our physical being. We can recondition it, we can exercise, we can study, we can do all sorts of things to make real change in it. Change is not transformation. Change stays within the given system. A transformation is when we're able to find a new source of being, when we find the soul's powers and bring them forward and surcharge nature with it. That changes it. Nature in an impactful way that the mere moving of the furniture does not. The same thing is true when we bring down a higher consciousness. It has an impact on the nature. We are importing from above a higher reality, a super nature, as it were, inviting it to come down. So we have to go in and then come out. We have to go above and then come back. Ascent and descent, and we're trying to integrate all of these fields, our inner awareness with the higher awareness established in the outer awareness, in ways that are meaningful, in ways that introduce new energies, new lights, a greater dimension of bliss into the world. That is transformation. So, Sri Aurobindo has brought his argument to that point and said, in the last phrases that we read last time, for the full spiritual transformation, more is needed. A permanent ascension from the lower into the higher consciousness and an effectual permanent descent of the higher into the lower nature. So, in a sense, mind can't be the topmost awareness for us if we're going to transform nature. We must arrive at this higher consciousness. Go beyond mind. But going beyond mind doesn't mean living above only. Always we keep our feet on the ground and our head above in the heavens, uniting the two. We are the bridge that brings the above to the below. We who practice yoga have this as our challenge. So we continue from here on the theme of this integration into ourselves of what is not our ordinary nature. This is the third motion, the descent, which is essential for bringing the permanent ascension, an increasing inflow from above, an experience of reception and retention of the descending spirit or its powers and elements of consciousness. This experience of descent can take place as a result of the other two movements, or automatically before either has happened, through a sudden rift in the lid, or a percolation, a downpour, or an influx. A light descends and touches or envelops or penetrates the lower being, the mind, the life, or the body. Or a presence or a power or a stream of knowledge pours in waves or currents. Or there is a flood of bliss or a sudden ecstasy. The contact with the superconscient has been established. For such experiences repeat themselves till they become normal, familiar, and well understood, revelatory of their contents and their significance, which may have at first been involved and wrapped into secrecy by the figure of the covering experience. For a knowledge from above begins to descend, frequently, constantly, then uninterruptedly, and to manifest in the mind's quietude or silence. Intuitions and inspirations, revelations born of a greater sight, a higher truth and wisdom enter into the being. A luminous intuitive discrimination works, which dispels all darkness of understanding or dazzling confusions, puts all in order. A new consciousness begins to form. The mind of a high, wide, self-existent thinking knowledge, or an illumined, or an intuitive, or an overmental consciousness with new forces of thought or sight, and a greater power of direct spiritual realization, which is more than thought or sight, a greater becoming in the spiritual substance of our present being. The heart and the sense become subtle, intense, large to embrace all existence, to see God, to feel and hear and touch the eternal, to make a deeper and closer unity of self and the world in a transcendent realization. Other decisive experiences, other changes of consciousness, determine themselves, which are corollaries and consequences of this fundamental change. No limit can be fixed to this revolution, for it is in its nature an invasion by the infinite. So here he describes experiences which became commonplace to him after first he investigated them in his own personal yoga. He found that they became watershed events, which then became familiar, constant, undiminished, ranging from the higher consciousness, which begins with the higher mind, all the way up to the overmental range. This, affected little by little, or in a succession of great and swift definitive experiences, is the process of the spiritual transformation. It achieves itself and culminates in an upward ascent, often repeated, by which in the end the consciousness fixes itself on a higher plane and from there sees and governs the mind, life, and body. It achieves itself also in an increasing descent of the powers of the higher consciousness and knowledge, which become more and more the whole normal consciousness and knowledge. A light and power, a knowledge and force are felt, which first take possession of the mind and remold it, afterwards of the life part and remold that, finally of the little physical consciousness and leave it no longer little, but wide and plastic and even infinite. For this new consciousness has itself the nature of infinity. It brings to us the abiding spiritual sense and awareness of the infinite and eternal, with a great largeness of the nature and a breaking down of its limits. Immortality becomes no longer a belief or an experience, but a normal self-awareness. The close presence of the divine being, his rule of the world and of our self and natural members, his force working in us and everywhere, the peace of the infinite, the joy of the infinite, are now concrete and constant in the being. In all sights and forms, one sees the eternal, the reality. In all sounds, one hears it. In all touches, feels it. There is nothing else but its forms and personalities and manifestations. The joy or adoration of the heart, the embrace of all existence, the unity of the spirit, are abiding realities. The consciousness of the mental creature is turning, or has been already turned, wholly into the consciousness of the spiritual being. This is the second of the three transformations, uniting the manifested existence with what is above it. It is the middle step of the three, the decisive transition of the spiritually evolving nature. So, as great and confirming and affirming as the finding of the soul is, it is when we widen into coexistence with the self, with the divine nature, who is everywhere, which is everything, and fix ourselves in that so that no longer do we fall into the gravid human condition, but remain aglow with this, in the light, the power, the ananda of the divine. Then we have got that second stage, and we are able to aim towards the future. If the spirit could from the first dwell securely on the superior heights and deal with the blank and virgin stuff of mind and matter, a complete spiritual transformation might be rapid, even facile. But the actual process of nature is more difficult, the logic of her movement more manifold, contorted, winding, comprehensive. She recognizes all the data of the task she has set to herself and is not satisfied with a summary triumph over her own complexities. Every part of our being has to be taken in its own nature and character, with all the molds and writings of the past still there in it. Each minutest portion and movement must either be destroyed and replaced if it is unfit, or if it is capable, transmuted into the truth of the higher being. If the psychic change is complete, this can be done by a painless process, though still the program must be long and scrupulous and the progress deliberate. But otherwise, one has to be satisfied with a partial result, or if one's own scrupulousness of perfection or hunger of the spirit is insatiable, consent to a difficult, often painful, and seemingly interminable action. For ordinarily, the consciousness does not rise to the summits, except in the highest moments. It remains on the mental level and receives descents from above, sometimes a single descent of some spiritual power that stays and molds the being into something predominatingly spiritual, or a succession of descents bringing into it more and more of the spiritual status and dynamis. But unless one can live on the highest height reached, there cannot be the complete or more integral change. If the psychic mutation has not taken place, if there has been a premature pulling down of the higher forces, their contact may be too strong for the flawed and impure material of nature, and its immediate fate may be that of the unbaked jar of the Veda, which could not hold the divine soma wine. Or the descending influence may withdraw or be spilt because the nature cannot contain or keep it. What he's describing here is, of course, the imperfections of the nature, or the inadequacy of the material to be able to be plastic to the molding of the spirit's touch. And if we can't undertake the full psychic change, then a number of things might occur. He begins the listing here, and of course he witnessed all of these things occur within the rank of his own followers, who would twist and turn and reach for something that they weren't prepared for, or not content to be led by the mother's force, would insist on carving their own path and come to some grief. He continues, again, if it is power that descends, the egoistic mind or vital may try to seize on it for its own use, and a magnified ego or a hunting after powers and self-aggrandizing masteries may be the untoward result. The Ananda descending cannot be held if there is too much sexual impurity, creating an intoxicant or degrading mixture. The power recedes. If there is ambition, vanity, or other aggressive form of lower self, the light, if there is an attachment to obscurity or to any form of the ignorance, the presence, if the chamber of the heart has not been made pure. Or some undivine force may try to seize hold, not of the power itself, for that withdraws, but of the result of force it leaves behind in the instrument, and use it for the purposes of the adversary. Even if none of these more disastrous faults or errors should take place, still, the numerous mistakes of reception or the imperfections of the vessel may impede the transformation. The power has to come at intervals and work meanwhile behind the veil, or hold itself back through long periods of obscure assimilation or preparation of the recalcitrant parts of nature. The light has to work in darkness or semi-darkness on the regions in us that are still in the night. At any moment, the work may be stayed, personally for this life, because the nature is able to receive or assimilate no more, for it has reached the present limits of its capacity, or because the mind may be ready, but the vital, when faced with a choice between the old life and the new, refuses. Or if the vital accepts, the body may prove too weak, unfit, or flawed for the necessary change of its consciousness and its dynamic transformation. So we can see that what we bring from our own nature to the process of the yoga demands from us great sincerity, dedication, a full consecration of ourselves to it, because even with all of that, to empower the practice of the yoga, we still will have moments where these things could assail some part in us which has a chink yet. We don't begin perfect. Nobody begins the practice of yoga from a state of perfection. So all of these things that I suggested that Sri Aurobindo had to deal with those who were following him on this path of integral yoga, he also faced within himself. This is the nature of the world. And since we live in the world lives in us. And so as we conquer these things, a step at a time, and assimilate, we get ready for the next step. It can be done, but we live in solidarity with the entire universe, which is why transformation takes considerable work and patient work. Probably a good time to mention that there is a cluster of wonderful letters in Letters on Yoga, Volume 3, in which Sri Aurobindo delves into this very topic of the triple transformation in grainy detail. So if you don't have that, Volume 3, and I'm talking about the collected works of Sri Aurobindo, the more recent, not the centenary library, but the more recent library of his collected works, you'll find it there. Moreover, the necessity of working out the change separately in each part of the being in its own nature and character compels the consciousness to descend into each in turn and act there according to its state and its possibility. If the work were done from above, from some spiritual height, there might be a sublimation or uplifting or the creation of a new structure compelled by the sheer force of the influence from above. But this change might not be accepted as native to itself by the lower being. It would not be a total growth, an integral evolution, but a partial and imposed formation, affecting or liberating some parts of the being, suppressing others, or leaving them as they were. A creation from outside the normal nature, by imposition upon it, it could be durable in its entirety only as long as there was a maintenance of the creating influence. So you'd have to be continually keeping pressure from above. It would not have become constant or familiar to the lower nature. That's why the descent is necessary, a full descent, not a pressure from above, not a radiance from above. We've tried that for millenniums in spiritual practice around the world. And it will light us up for a period of time, but it will not change nature, which is our goal. A descent of consciousness into the lower levels is therefore necessary. But in this way also, it is difficult to work out the full power of the higher principle. There is a modification, dilution, diminution, which keeps up an imperfection and limitation in the results. The light of a greater knowledge comes down, but gets blurred and modified, its significance misinterpreted, or its truth mixed with mental and vital error, or the force, the power to fulfill itself, is not commensurate with its light. A light and power of the overmind working in its own full right and in its own sphere is one thing. The same light working in the obscurity of the physical consciousness and under its conditions is something quite different, and owing to dilution and mixture, far inferior in its knowledge and force and results. A mutilated power, a partial effect or hampered movement is the consequence. And again, he knows this from experience, because he brought into the active play of his physical nature the full descent of the overmind and all of its power, and found that it was not sufficient to change the material basis. A powerful influence? Yes. In fact, it was visible in his body. His body glowed like gold. But it was not the change that he sought. And you could see that the descent of the overmental consciousness could not change its matrix. The supramental can change the vessel in which it dwells, that the overmind could descend and settle and still not bring the body to the full scope of divinity was proof to him that the ascent to the Gnostic consciousness above had to continue. It had to be brought down in its full splendor and power. This is indeed the reason of the slow and difficult emergence of the consciousness force in nature. For mind and life have to descend into matter and suit themselves to its conditions. Changed and diminished by the obscurity and reluctant inertia of the substance and force in which they work, they are not able to make a complete transformation of their material into a fit instrument and a changed substance revelatory of their real and native power. The life consciousness is unable to effectuate the greatness and felicity of its mighty or beautiful impulses in the material existence. Its impetus fails it. Its force of effectuation is inferior to the truth of its conceptions. The form betrays the life intuition within it, which it tries to render into terms of life being. The mind is unable to achieve its high ideas in the medium of life or matter without deductions and compromises which deprive them of their divinity. Its clarities of knowledge and will are not matched by its force to mold this inferior substance to obey and express it. On the contrary, its own powers get affected. Its will is divided, its knowledge confused and clouded by the turbidities of life and the incomprehension of matter. Neither life nor mind succeeds in converting or perfecting the material existence because they cannot attain to their own full force in these conditions. They need to call in a higher power to liberate and fulfill them. But the higher spiritual mental powers also undergo the same disability when they descend into life and matter. They can do much more, achieve much luminous change, but the modification, the limitation, the disparity between the consciousness that comes in and the force of effectuation that it can mentalize and materialize are constantly there, and the result is a diminished creation. The change made is often extraordinary. There is even something which looks like a total conversion and reversal of the state of consciousness and an uplifting of its movements, but it is not dynamically absolute. So, mind and life cannot change the way the world works. If we don't evolve beyond mind to a greater power, we cannot change matter. We can only influence it. We can brighten it, but we can't transform it. He continues, only the supermind can thus descend without losing its full power of action. For its action is always intrinsic and automatic, its will and knowledge identical, and the result commensurate. Its nature is a self-achieving truth consciousness, and if it limits itself or its working, it is by choice and intention, not by compulsion. In the limits it chooses its action, and the results of its action are harmonious and inevitable. Again, overmind is, like mind, a dividing principle, and its characteristic operation is to work out in an independent formation a selected harmony. Its global action enables it to its global action enables it indeed to create a harmony whole and perfect in itself, or to unite or fuse its harmonies together, to synthesize. But laboring under the restrictions of mind, life, and matter, it is obliged to do it by sections and their joinings. So we'll pause for a moment. The verb synthesize, that's the correct form, by the way, not synthesize. Synthesize means a synthesis is a bringing together of elements. It means building up or bringing together all the parts into a whole, into an integrated whole. Integrated means one, right? Its tendency of totality is hampered by its selective tendency, which is accentuated by the nature of the mental and life material in which it is working here. What it can achieve is separate, limited spiritual creations, each perfect in itself, but not the integral knowledge and its manifestation. So these are the limits of the overmind. It brings a harmonic, even a universal vision, but it is selective. It is not the full radiance of the omnipresent supramental consciousness. He continues. For this reason, and because of the diminishing of its native light and power, it is unable to do what it is unable to do fully what is needed, and has to call in a greater power, the supramental force, to liberate and fulfill it. As the psychic change has to call in the spiritual to complete it, so the first spiritual change has to call in the supramental transformation to complete it. For all these steps forward are, like those before them, transitional. The whole radical change in the evolution from a basis of ignorance to a basis of knowledge can only come by the intervention of the supramental power and its direct action in earth existence. This, then, must be the nature of the third and final transformation, which finishes the passage of the soul through the ignorance and bases its consciousness, its life, its power and form of manifestation on a complete and completely effective self-knowledge. The truth consciousness, finding evolutionary nature ready, has to descend into her and enable her to liberate the supramental principle within her. So must be created the supramental and spiritual being as the first unveiled manifestation of the truth of the self and spirit in the material universe. So two things are there in that last sentence. The truth consciousness from above, watching the evolutionary process here, must see that nature is ready before it prods us forward to achieve the supramental change of consciousness. We have to be ready. Part of the job of the yogin is to prepare the nature, to prepare the vehicle. Mind, life, and body, not just the body, the whole vehicle into a shining harmonic whole. And then that consciousness has to come in and find the supramental principle within her. The her here is the natural instrument. In other words, inherently, the supramental consciousness exists already in matter. It is the striking upon the hidden supermind in matter by the descending supermind from above that forms a nexus, a golden nexus, and allows that to flower, to come into full being. So here we are. The triple transformation. Changing the nature to reflect the glow of the soul. Changing the nature to reflect the vastness of the spiritual reality beyond the universe, but in the universe as well. And the third, the greatest transformation, the supramental, which we have yet to do. To attain the first, the psychic, is to give you the key to enter the second. Some begin with the second and come back to the first. But until the two are paired, until the soul is awake and one with the universe, it is imprudent to think that one is ready for the supramental. So the next chapter is the ascent to supermind. Chapter 26 we take up next week. Tonight, we'll read from Savitri in a section late in the book. This is Book 10, the Book of the Double Twilight, Canto 4, The Dream Twilight of the Earthly Real. On summit mind are radiant altitudes exposed to the luster of infinity, outskirts and dependencies of the house of truth, upraised estates of mind and measureless. There man can visit, but there he cannot live. A cosmic thought spreads out its vastitudes. Its smallest parts are here philosophies, challenging with their detailed immensity, each figuring an omniscient scheme of things. But higher still can climb the ascending light. There are vasts of vision and eternal suns, oceans of an immortal luminousness, flame hills assaulting heaven with their peaks. There dwelling all becomes a blaze of sight. A burning head of vision leads the mind. Thought trails behind it, its long comet tail. The heart glows, an illuminate and seer, and sense is kindled into identity. A highest flight climbs to a deepest view. In a wide opening of its native sky, intuition's lightnings range in a bright pack, hunting all hidden truths out of their lairs. Its fiery edge of seeing, absolute, cleaves into locked, unknown retreats of self, rummages the sky recesses of the brain, lights up the occult chambers of the heart. Its spear point ictus of discovery, pressed on the cover of name, the screen of form, strips bare the secret soul of all that is. Thought there has revelation's sunbright eyes. The word, a mighty and inspiring voice, enters truth's inmost cabin of privacy and tears away the veil from God and life. Then stretches the boundless finite's last expanse, the cosmic empire of the overmind, time's buffer state bordering eternity, too vast for the experience of man's soul. All here gathers beneath one golden sky. The powers that build the cosmos station take in its house of infinite possibility. Each god from there builds his own nature's world. Ideas are phalanxed like a group of suns, each marshaling his company of rays. I think we'll have cause to continue with that passage in coming weeks. So, namaste. Jai Ma.